Oh, the car from Carvana's here. Well, will you look at that? It's exactly what I ordered. Like, precisely. It would be crazy if there were any catches. But there aren't, right?
Right. Because that's how car buying should be. With Carvana, you get the car you want. Choose delivery or pickup and a week to love it or return it.
Buy your car today with
Carvana.
Delivery or pickup fees may apply. Limitations and exclusions may apply. See our 7-day return policy at Carvana.com.
All right, remember, the machine knows if you're lying. First statement, Carvana will give you a real offer on your car all online.
False.
True, actually. Oh. You can sell your car in minutes.
False? That's gotta be...
True again. Carvana will pick up your car from your door, or you can drop it off at one of their car vending machines.
Sounds too good to be true, so true.
Finally caught on. Nice job. Honesty isn't just their policy, it's their entire model. Sell your car today, too.
Carvana.
Pickup fees may apply.
It was something Murray said to us. Marvelous thing about Formula One. It always finds a way of reinventing itself. Don't know how. Who pops up to join our little guild of pit reporters, but one Juan Pablo Montoya. You know, a guy who would quite happily have run me down in his in his Williams or his McLaren if I was out in the way in the pit lane.
Are you the coolest dad at the school gate?
I don't know about that.
Hello and welcome to the James Allen on F1 podcast brought to you by Autosport. This week, I'm delighted to welcome an old friend, a bona fide sports broadcasting legend who's carved his own niche, patrolling the F1 pit lane for Sky Sports F1, BBC and ITV. His Ted's Notebook segment on the Sky coverage is a must for all fans of the sport. He's just released a new book telling his story, as well as some great stories and anecdotes from his 25 plus years in the role. Ted Kravitz, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, James. Amazing to be here, and incredible that we can do this, really. And you know, it's strange in a way because having known each other, you know, professionally and personally for almost 30 years, we've never actually sat down, you and I, you as the person who, you know, defined the role of the modern pit reporter, and to talk about the job and what it is. It's the sort of first time in 27, 30 years where we've actually been able to sit down and talk about it. Just so happens I've written a book about it. But I'll be asking you as many questions as you'll be asking me.
Well, we'll see about that, Ted. but congratulations, first of all, on the book, F1 Insider, Notes from the Pit Lane, which is out in the run-up now to Christmas. I would definitely encourage anyone who's interested in Formula One to pick up this book, not least because it tells the kind of behind-the-scenes stories and describes life on the road and describes the travel. But it's also got some fabulous sort of memories and moments and descriptions from, like, so many dramatic things that happened in the last sort of 25-plus years in Formula One. We'll get on to all of that over the next half hour, 40 minutes or so. But it's your first book about your life in F1. Why now, and did you enjoy the writing process?
Well, why now? Because I think it's probably good that you have almost 30 years, you know, in the business, so you've actually got something to write about. I always wonder after people, you know, people write books after 5 years in their chosen field, and you think, well, where are the stories? Unless they've had a particularly intense career, which is fair enough. And also, I just felt that these are stories that are well known. I mean, the book seeks to do two things. The first thing is that these are stories that are well known. We all know the story of, you know, Michael Schumacher. Heaven knows that your books, James, have told the story of Michael Schumacher better than I ever could. We know the story about Indianapolis 2005, the six-car race. We know Austria 02 with a controversy between Schumacher and Barrichello. The fairy tale Braun, you know, Phoenix from the Ashes type thing. We all know these stories. What people don't know, and hopefully what this delivers in this book, is what they... the aspects and the retelling of those stories from my point of view and what I saw and interviews I did and the way that we came at it from a TV point of view, which, of course, you know, is a slightly strange one in terms of what the finished product is on TV or indeed radio is not always how you sort of start to go there in the first place. That's the first thing it seeks to do. And secondly, again, interesting, given that we're talking, is I wanted to do a bit of a How to Be a Pit Reporter book. And I felt that, Yeah, this is a slightly, as Anthony Davidson calls it, a made-up job, which is the first chapter. It's not a made-up. Well, if it is a made-up job, then you made it up, and I've run with it. But it's not a made-up job. It's an essential job, I think, to modern Formula One, largely because, you know, that's what you defined. And I wanted to give people some insight into what it is, how it's done, the best way to do it, its place in a sport that we all love.
Well, it's a job that you do very well and with great charisma. But I think what comes through for me from the book is that you have to have curiosity to do a job like this. But you're also privileged, especially if you're observant, you're privileged to be in the room when it happens, or indeed in the garage when it happens, yeah, in the moments that are, you know, the defining moments of Formula One. You've got some great examples of that. You know, the Indianapolis 05 and many other stories. And of course, the famous, you know, last lap in Brazil, 2008, Lewis Hamilton's first world championship. Yeah. Just tell me about that curiosity, because, I mean, you patrol the pit lane, you see what you see. What when you go out to work for a Grand Prix and millions of listeners around the world are sort of waiting to hear from you things they can't see on the screen, what are you looking for, and what sort of turns you on?
I mean, it started with numbers. I mean, I dedicate the book to my parents, and I thank them for buying the papers, because, you know, when we were young, James, there wasn't the internet, and we couldn't follow Formula One in the way that many people can today. And so I used to scour the papers for stories, and sometimes they were few and far between. But there was always, at least on a Sunday, there was a qualifying grid, and there was a qualifying classification with the numbers, and I was keen on numbers. I wasn't great at maths, but I liked numbers as a boy growing up. They presented some kind of order in the world that I was still sort of, you know, dealing with as an adolescent. So they were reassuring, I think, as a way. And so I used to kind of create ideas and almost sort of qualifying reports in my head, looking at the numbers and seeing the gaps and seeing how close people were. And that's translated, that's just developed into a curiosity about the drivers, the technology, the motivations, the politics about it all. It helps being observant, obviously, as curiosity, which you say. I am naturally observant, and I can see a car from week to week and think, oh, that wasn't there last week, or what's that bit? And then if I, you know, engage an engineer or a mechanic and explain to me what that bit is or what it does, then, and this is something else that you taught me, it's explaining to my viewer or listener how that affects the racing. And that was always something that you were very strong on, not only a brilliant storyteller, but you said, look, how does this affect the racing?
The
and
what
that
next,
stayed yeah. with me. The what next, exactly. And that stayed with me. So, you know, as well as being, you know, a huge influence on me, you know, where you started, I think we did the job slightly differently, but in those key elements of observation, curiosity, you know, a little bit of admiration, respect, and reserving the opportunity to be wowed as well. You know, it's, you can't go into Formula One, plenty of people do, and just think, oh, you know, that was great, or wow, you know, that was a good pole position or something. You need to be wowed sometimes, because that's what you're translating, that's what you're projecting to your audience. So I'll always remind myself to kind of step out of the bubble sometimes and see that bigger picture. Again, something you're brilliant at, just encapsulating that bigger picture of people. You know, today we saw this, that, and the other. Yeah, making it mean something for our viewers, which is the point.
The sport is fascinating for so many reasons. It's a sort of two-part question, I think. The first one is, what is it you love most about Formula One and working in Formula One?
I mean... It's so strange us doing this, because in the beginning of the last chapter, I don't even know if you remember it, it was something Murray said to us when we were in one of those Australian minivans with all our luggage going from Melbourne Airport to the Bayview on the Park Hotel. And you might not remember it, but, you know, he did say, apropos of absolutely nothing, I think it was early in the morning, we were all slightly knackered after a 24-hour flight. And he said, you know, marvelous thing about Formula One, it always finds a way of reinventing itself. Don't know how, you know, every year. And, you know, what probably wasn't an entirely new observation, but it just keeps coming back to me how Formula One, strange sport as it is, business and everything else just finds a way to reinvent itself year after year, whether it's new teams, new drivers, new rules, whether they work or not sometimes, personalities, bigger, larger than life personalities, you know, even with the disasters that come along, and there's a chapter called dealing with disasters. It finds a way of being new and fun and relevant and interesting. And that's what hooked me. And I think what hooks people we communicate with as well.
Yeah. And I think it's also, there's what I love about it as well is the extreme personalities. You know, yeah. I grew up with a racing driver father, so I knew about that kind of rage to compete and what the kind of the mentality of racers. But it, what really blew me away when I started working in Formula One was just how extreme people like Ayrton Senna, you know, Alain Prost, Ron Dennis, Frank Williams, Ross Brawn, and you know, people like Alonso today and you know, Leclerc and Hamilton. I mean, they put themselves in extreme situations. What's the most intense situation you've ever found yourself in this job in Formula One, where you were like, literally, you're sort of like, almost like G-forces on your cheeks because the kind of the intensity of the moment was like almost overwhelming?
Oh my goodness, there are so many. I mean, you remember, you know, Jerez 97 was pretty intense, wasn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, you were in the garage when Ron, it was the McLaren garage, wasn't it? And Patrick Head came into the McLaren.
That's correct.
The McLaren garage. Ron was beckoned off the wall.
They were doing a deal.
And they were doing a deal.
Against Schumacher and Ferrari.
That's right. Yeah. That was pretty intense. I mean, I was only in the commentary box, but I could hear you discussing it with our producer Neil Duncanson at the time. And then, you know, so many. I mean, talk about Austria 2002. There was an intense moment in the pit lane afterwards talking to Ross Brawn.
You really confronted Hungary. Him there, didn't you?
Yeah, because you know, as a journalism was different back then. Formula One journalism was different back then, and there was an expectation, I think, from the audience that you would have to be seen to be asking these tough questions. And it's changed a bit since then.
Well, I mean, there were boos and catcalls coming from the grandstands. Yeah. For those listeners who are not fully aware of what happened, Schumacher already had a comfortable lead in the Drivers' Championship. It was May or something, very early in the championship. Barrichello was dominating the weekend and the race, and Ferrari made him give the race win to Schumacher. Schumacher then tried to make Barrichello stand on the top step of the podium. The whole thing was a dog's breakfast from PR point of view. And you were fronting up Ross and saying, you know, that was not good. And he was a bit upset with the way you ended the interview, which you put in the book as well, that you kind of, you learned something that day that you need to actually say, thank you for your time.
Yes.
And then turn away.
As
opposed to saying it as you walked away and him then thinking you'd been really rude to him and having a bit of a stand up with him in the next round.
Yeah. I came up to him in Monaco and was like, okay, you know, can we have an interview? And he's like, oh, you want to talk to me now, do you? I said, what do you mean? He's like, you just turned away from me and you didn't like my answer. And what he couldn't see, obviously, was I was saying, okay, thanks very much, Ross. You know, I was still on my own mic. So listeners and viewers would have heard the end of the interview and heard thanks, Ross. But because we had, you know, I mean, it was a zoo, those pit lanes with all the reporters. And you remember what it was? It was you and Louise who actually instigated the TV pen in Formula One to try and control some of this chaos. Mm. And then after a race, the scrums like this were going on. And we were, you know, we've got four or five or six crews, many more than there are today for some reason. And it was just a real bun fight and you had to get in there. But what I liked and why I transcribed your brilliant commentary at the end of Brazil 2008 with Hamilton, I've got to say, with the possible exception of Abu Dhabi 2021 for very different reasons, that was probably the most intense, don't you think? I mean, the reason why, you know, your brilliant commentary, for which, of course, you won a BAFTA, that commentary, didn't you? See, I told you this was turning into a me interviewing you podcast. I mean, that commentary was just so perfect and spot on. I just thought I had to transcribe it word for word. Harum scarum. I can't find it at the moment, but in the most harum scarum way, it's absolutely perfect. Would you have said that was probably one of the most intense times?
Oh, it was very intense. It was all about finding your way to the right answer, because obviously Massa won the race. So he'd done everything that he had to do, everything he could do that was in his control. And then it was just in the lap of the gods as to whether the rain would intensify. And I remember those terrible commentary boxes in Sao Paulo that were kind of like tin boxes, basically. And I remember opening the back door just behind where Martin and I were standing to actually see with my own eyes how much heavier the rain was falling, and whether or not Glock and Trulli and the Toyotas, who were still on slicks, were going to get caught. And you could see it was just the intensity of the rain increasing. All the conspiracy theorists who think that, you know, Glock basically sort of was in some sort of giant conspiracy for Hamilton to win the championship.
Yeah.
They weren't there that day. They didn't see how heavy the rain was and the fact that Glock was on worn slicks. But,
100,000 hearts sink in the grandstand. You remember that line?
Yeah, I love it.
That was such a great line. I still steal it sometimes.
Speaking of commentary boxes, you mentioned to this earlier one, what perhaps a lot of people won't remember is that your first job in Formula One TV was actually as what was called the commentary box producer with the great Murray Walker in the final years of his Formula One career. And of course, Martin Brundle, who'd got out of the cockpit of the Jordan in 1996 and straight into the commentary box.
Grudgingly.
Yes.
Straight in.
But always a brilliant broadcaster. There was never any doubt he was going to be a great commentator because it was such a great interview when he was a driver. And you therefore had to kind of give instructions to Murray and hand up boards and all that sort of thing. But you've got some lovely stories in the book about dealing with him and his warm-up routines and his way of being. But what I love is you describe it as just, you know, at the end of the day, what made him very special, he had a voice that sounded like a racing engine.
Yes.
And B, he absolutely loved what he was talking about. And I guess those years working with him must have rubbed off in a big way on you and informed the kind of the way that you think about sports broadcasting.
Yes, and in combination with your work and communication and ability to encapsulate a story was probably the best schooling that anybody could have to do this job. So I was extremely lucky in that regard. And to understand, and what I'm pleased about looking back is how much those times that we lived through that we didn't realize would come to be significant, how much I took in and understood what Murray was doing in those moments and the way he used to watch practice, for example. And we look at practice now and we broadcast it and we think, you know, it's all part of the TV offering, and some people might watch it, some people might not. But, you know, if people do want to, it's quite interesting. Watching effectively training, you know, no one broadcasts football teams doing their training in London Colney or wherever. And what Murray was doing was he was practicing too, but in a kind of silent way. He wasn't going through, you know, ideas, but he was just glued to that screen. And I used to think, you know, why is he doing it? What's he watching? What's he doing? And then he would annotate his track map. It was a brilliant idea as to what the advertising hoarding was at each corner. Because when a driver went off or something happened, he wanted to be able to say, at turn 7 or at turn 2 or at Copse or at Mergulho or Junshao or wherever, obviously Eau Rouge and Radion is quite easy to say. But if there's a corner where he doesn't know, and it would help to know what the advertising hoarding is, what brand it is in the background. And he'd write that down. And then I always liked the way the research that he did, which was meticulous and detailed, he wouldn't always try. He'd judge in his own journalistic mind, because he was an enthusiast, but a journalist as well, I think it's fair to say, as well as a brilliant communicator, what was important for people to know in a quiet moment of the race. And I remember sometimes he'd have them little notes to himself on the side of the commentary box, sometimes he wouldn't. It is in many ways, there are a couple of chapters which are a bit of a love letter to Murray Walker, but listening to him, being with him in the commentary box, and then listening to what you were doing in the pit lane as well was pretty good training for the job I eventually got. And the cue cards, he couldn't take talk back. That was the funny thing about Murray, despite being a complete professional.
Like talking in his ear, yeah.
Like a driver in the middle of 130R, being talked to on the radio. He didn't like getting talk back. And so that's where the cue cards came in. Whether it was James in pits, go to Louise, lead to break, not go to break, because he would have said, it's lap 35 and we're going to a break. As you remember, at ITV, we were quite sort of, sensitive, I think, about the way we did it. And heaven knows you had to do plenty of that as well. But yeah, it was a real formative years.
You're listening to the James Allen and F1 podcast, part of the Autosport Podcast Network. For the latest from our reporters at the racetrack during F1 weekends, head to the Autosport F1 channel.
The whole game has changed so much in the last few years under Liberty Media. Your coverage is now, it always was broadcast, even in my day, in Australia, South Africa, New Zealand, Canada, all over the English-speaking world, but not necessarily the US, but now it's in the US as well. How have you had to sort of tailor the way that you do what you do, mindful of the fact that the particularly the US audiences have been, you know, have been really important to the growth story of Formula One in the last few years?
Very interesting question. Briefly, two ways. Sometimes they join us at the pit lane open, which is 20 past the hour. Sometimes they join us for the grid walk. Sometimes they join us at a different time. If I know that they're joining us at pit lane open, we do a little hype piece, I think it's fair to say, where I stand at the end of the pit lane and do a little bit about how they're leaving the pits and weather conditions, track conditions, whether anyone's doing a particularly good practice start or bad one. And it's an excitement point of punctuating the build-up with a bit of energy. And if I know that that ESPN or whoever it is joining us at that time, then I will do a little bit of a story of the weekend, or I'll put it in, you know, Lando Norris coming here off two wins in a row, knowing that a lot of sports broadcasting in the US is, they like a little statistic to put things in context, you know, coming here, looking for a third in a row or something. And it's not bad for everybody else, all right? It might be sort of the American way to put a few statistics in whatever you're doing. But I do have a little bit of that in mind. And then during the commentary, again, something that you pioneered and I learned from you is just don't overstay your welcome. Get in there, drop your little nugget of your story and get out, because it's not about the pit guy, and as maybe a US audience would say. And that's the way they're used to having their sports broadcasts. You know, there's the play-by-play, and then they will have, you know, a reporter on the side. They'll come in, make it clear, and then get out. So it does have a bit of a influence, but I don't think that harms any other market that we're broadcasting, whether it's the UK or South Africa or New Zealand, Australia. But I am mindful of other places that we broadcast to.
And what about fan feedback, whether it's from the US or the UK or other English speaking countries? What kind of feedback do you get? And, you know, have you done anything to kind of the, you know, what do they ask for more of? What do they ask for less of from you? What do they like about what you do?
It always amazes me how much people like the logistical side of Formula One. And they say, can you do, and we do a piece, we must do a piece at least once every couple of years, and maybe even more frequently than that, about how these motorhomes and these amazing Formula One teams move from place to place, from continent to continent. And when people ask, it's like, can you please do a feature about, you know, how these teams move around, I'm tempted to write back and say, you know, we did one, here's the link. But of course, people can't watch all of our coverage all the time. Hopefully people do as much as they can. But there's a lot of that. There's a lot of very valuable feedback in terms of, you know, we think you should look at this. So I'll get, you know, suggestions on why is Yuki Tsunoda struggling, or what is it with Carlos Sainz or something. And they'll put some germs of ideas in my head, and which I'll develop. So yeah, we do get contacted quite a bit, and I'll sort of read everything. Won't get back to everybody. Won't be able to get back to everybody. But yeah, you always have to think of your audience, because that's what we're doing it for. You know, I mean, I think it was probably you again who said it's that connection that you're making with your audience, and that's why at the end when I'm sort of wrapping it up, I sort of say, look, it's all for you. I'm not there asking Ross Brawn why he did an unnecessary driver swap, you know, or demanded that Barrichello give the lead. I'm not there for my own curiosity. Well, I mean, I am, but I am curious. But it's not for me, I'm asking that. It's a conduit. We are conduits for our viewers and listeners.
Yeah, and one of the things that you brought in, which is obviously, as I mentioned at the top, a real fan favourite, is Ted's Notebook, which I guess is the sort of bookend of the race to Martin Brundle's Grid Walk, which started in the summer of 1997. It's a British Grand Prix. Mm-hmm. He first went down onto the grid and had a wander about and sort of chatted to a few people, and it became a broadcasting institution, won in many awards. And your notebook is a kind of slightly, well, it's not slightly, it's a free-form ramble down the pit lane with notes that you've made during the weekend.
That, a rambling monologue.
Yes. That is, well, I wouldn't call it a rambling monologue. I think it's a few occasional interactions with people coming past. But yeah. First of all, it's well known that Martin doesn't actually enjoy doing the grid walk. He doesn't really welcome the pressure and all the rest of it. But do you actually enjoy doing the notebook? And what makes a good notebook when you sign off and you think that was a good one? What are the elements that will make you feel that was a good one?
I do enjoy it. I still get a bit nervous, and I think it's good to be nervous. I think if you're not nervous when going on live TV, you're probably not doing it right in some way. You need a bit of a few nerves. And when I feel that I have, got all the information that I had on the two pages of my notebook out, and I haven't left anything out, then I'm happy. And B, when I feel that we've either broken a story or two or moved some stories on with some new content and information for the viewer or the listener, and when I know that we've covered everything that they might see in the next few days, or as much as possible. Because that's, you know, the other marvelous thing about F1 these days is that there is pretty, I think it's pretty rare to think of some stories that teams or drivers manage to keep themselves that's happened in a race or a qualifying. More or less, everything gets out sooner or later. And certainly the next February in Drive to Survive, you know, I mean, if they choose to include it. So what I hate happening is that on a Monday or a Tuesday, somebody, whether it's via a feed of a foreign broadcaster's pen camera that maybe wasn't broadcast. Franco Colapinto feeling faint and having to have a sit down after Monza is a good example. And I got a tip off from someone wondering up just before I was doing the notebook. It's like, have you heard what happened to Colapinto? I was like, no, what do you mean? They said, oh, well, something's going on. Didn't tell me. And so I had to go and, you know, I went and found out. I spoke to the guys in the pen from ESPN Latin America, and they were like, yeah, he came over and was feeling a bit unsteady. I had to go and sit down to contact himself. Checked with Alpine, Sam from Alpine, you know, and he was like, everything's fine. And but the way you do is with stories, you know. And it was only a quick line in the notebook. It was like Franco Colapinto who was, you know, feeling a pretty dodgy in the pen, but, you know, he's okay. And he did this and that and the other. It just pleases me that the viewer will then go away, will see those pictures, which inevitably make it to social media, and think, aha, I knew about this because Ted told me about on the notebook. And also the point of the notebook is when I miss a race, and we don't do, none of us at Sky F1 do all the races just to keep us fresh. I miss, it's not possible sometimes if you have a family or other things to do to watch 4 hours of coverage on a Sunday. And if you missed what happened in the F1 race, it's nice to have at the end of the day something that will, in 24 minutes, which will sum up what happened in the Grand Prix. And that's the intention, as well as telling all the stories, that's the intention of the notebook, just to sum everything up.
So another part of this job, obviously, is interviewing people, and that is an art form. On the front cover of your book, Toto Wolff gives you a lovely quote where he says, a fascinating and unique insight from one of F1's most formidable reporters, which is an interesting adjective to choose. Who in the F1 paddock do you enjoy interviewing the most?
Well, I have to say Toto now, don't I? I mean, I think that's what sometimes when obviously Mercedes had this amazing run of 8 consecutive constructors championships, but there were some times when I had to, you know, stick Toto with a difficult question. But he understands the game. He understands that I'm asking just for, because I don't want anybody watching us on the sofa to think, well, why didn't you ask him the question I want to ask him? So I think I hope that's what he means by formidable. So you have to ask those questions. I think what you and Louise Goodman actually, our colleague and friend, taught me was that sometimes it's not productive to go in to Dr. Martin's my sometime choice of footwear
2 feet first.
First. Because you will get a better answer if you just couch it in terms of, you know, can you explain what happened there? Or rather than, well, that was rubbish, wasn't it? Or what did you do that for? But the other thing, and I'd like to hear whether you think this is still necessary, is that different drivers react differently to different approaches. Some drivers, Kimi Raikkonen being a good example, although actually I did learn in the end how to get a good and lengthy answer from Kimi Raikkonen. There was a little bit of an art to it, an art that people mistakenly either didn't think was worth pursuing or found it amusing not to pursue and just to get a one-word answer from him. But that was a silly thing to do, in fact, because when Kimi gave an answer, if you listened to what he was saying, he was actually extremely illuminating, very good and often very honest and very frank. The other thing people don't realize sometimes is that those pen interviews, the drivers are asked the same thing again and again and again. And I will always just go in, even if it's the same topic, just with a little bit of a curveball, a different way of doing it, something that will just catch them off guard is maybe the wrong word, but unusual, a little bit of an unusual start. And then go for it. But that was, it all started with your advice to me with Michael, really, as how to formulate and how to catch Michael's attention. Because I hope I tell it correctly, in that, you know, you told me, look, Michael is probably the most keenly aware that media stuff that he has to do because the teams, sponsors, whatever demand it, will not make him or his car faster. So you have to give him something in there. You have to give him something, some knowledge he didn't already have, which might not be, you know, what might be quite difficult to do, something that makes him think or something that increases his communication with his fans, with his audience, and makes him, puts him in a better light, for example. That was some of the best advice you ever gave me, amongst all the good advice you gave me, was to think very carefully, knowing Michael as well as you did, about which kind of questions and how to formulate your questions to him. Maybe you'd like to explain what that was.
I can't remember, Ted. It's a long time ago. No, I think the thing with Raikkonen and with Michael, I mean, it's there's certain things you learn with dealing with these people. Like Lewis Hamilton, you ask him open questions. Never ask Lewis Hamilton a closed question.
Yes.
Because it's just, you're not going to get an answer out of him. With Kimi, it was actually much more straightforward than people realize. You just had to, first of all, make it an intelligent question, not an obvious question, and keep it simple, actually, because an open question, because, you know, he actually could speak quite, he was, you know, he had to, when he felt like it, he could give you a really good answer. Yeah. And with Michael, it was, you know, it was, there's a certain amount of respect that you have to sort of build up with him over time. It's like a cumulative thing. Once he knows that you're not going to ask him something idiotic or put him in the spot, you build a certain level of trust, because Michael was a very sensitive person wrapped in a very hard shell that he had to build around himself as an adolescent, you know, in a very tough environment. So once you tapped into that and you understood that you know, he needed to feel secure, crazy as that may seem with one of the hardest men in world sport, then you could find that rapport and build it from there. So that was it. But
Just parallels with Max Verstappen, with Michael in some
way. Max is like halfway between him and Kimi, I think. Max is, I haven't done, obviously it's a long time since I've done television, so and I didn't really overlap with Max in his racing, his F1 career, but my dealings with Max is he's extremely straightforward.
Yes.
Dutch, you know, so, you know, and you just have to be straight with him, you know,
and he appreciates that, and he actually will penalize, punish maybe is the wrong word, but if you try and hedge around the issue, prevaricate around the bush, as Wallace and Gromit would put it, then he'll kind of punish that question, and it's just much better just to come out and say it, because he respects that.
But it's interesting, when I watch the TV coverage, and it always surprises me, Formula One drivers generally are pretty intelligent, and in general, they don't give pat answers. They try to say something, and it's amazing the quality actually of the answers that you manage to get out of them, especially in a live situation. We've just been driving a car for, you know, with 180, 200 beats per minute heart rate for 90 minutes, and, you know, a few minutes later they're being asked a question or several questions, and they manage to come out with really eloquent things. So I won't put you on the spot and ask you in today's grid who you've had trouble with, but if who from the past, you know, that you dealt with, who did you have the most trouble with, whether it's drivers or team principals, and any like really chunky run-ins with anybody?
I don't think there were really. I can't think of any. I mean, we had a funny moment last weekend in Monza when who pops up to join our little guild of pit reporters, but one Juan Pablo Montoya, who was being a pit reporter. I mean, talk about, you know, a guy who used to, would quite happily have run me down in his in his Williams or his McLaren if I was out in the way in the pit lane. It's like, get out of the way. Was a pit reporter for F1 TV. Those days of the rivalry between Montoya and Ralf Schumacher could get a bit prickly. And you needed to know, ironically, given that he's now a colleague of mine on Sky Germany, you need to know how to ask Ralf Schumacher questions as well. He would be quite happy to put you away if he just felt like it, whether he didn't wanted to answer the question or not. But that was always quite tasty because their relationship was quite tasty, Montoya and Ralf Schumacher at Williams. Who else? I can't really think. I've always, with Lewis, it's always worked well. Sebastian has always been a great, you know, professional relationship that we managed to forge, largely because I was there in the beginning of his career when no one else really wanted to talk to him.
I remember you and me at right very early doors in talking to him when he was about 19 or something, yeah, at Toro Rosso. Do you remember that?
Yes.
The three of us sat in the hospitality once, just sort of chewing the fat for about half an hour, very early days. And that was the first time I realized how intelligent he was.
Yes, you cottoned on very quickly that here was a guy not only with world, you know, multiple world championship potential, but someone who's extremely switched on, and there was that brightness in his eyes, wasn't there, that continued even towards the end, and now persists with the curiosity and the involvement that he has in other projects, you know, whether it's in the Amazon rainforest and something. So Sebastian there, but no, I can't really think of any really difficult people. Did you really have any? I mean, you, interesting through your experience in the US in IndyCar, maybe there were some more strong individuals there who resisted.
Well, no, because in IndyCar, they're in the service of the TV company. The dynamic is 180 degrees different, whereas, you know, in Formula One, you're desperately trying to get the attention of the drivers and the teams, and they're doing you a favor by speaking to you. It's completely the other way around in IndyCar. So, no, I don't. I mean, you know, I had a massive stand-up row once with Ross Brawn, but then we squared it away and we get on super well now. Yeah. And Eddie Irvine could be a bit tricky, but I also had great moments with Eddie. So,
yeah.
No, it's. I mean, the thing is, there's a small pool in which, you know, of lead characters in this drama, and it doesn't pay to upset them too much. But yeah, you do have to ask the tough questions. Just moving on a little bit, I mean, we mentioned earlier on this, the explosion of popularity of the sport, particularly in the US, but also amongst the female fan base. I mean, there's so many. You've got three daughters. I'm sure, I don't know if they're Formula One fans, but I'm sure quite a lot of their friends are Formula One fans. So are you the coolest dad at the school gates?
I don't know about that. There are, I mean, my daughters find it hilarious when, you know, people say, come up and say hello in the street and roll their eyes, you know. And but I'm not sure about that. But what pleases me about the new fan base and the new profile of the fan base that we have is that they're discovering what we loved about Formula One, and they're just finding a different way into it. And I don't think there's any difference at all in what a female fan base will find interesting to what a male one is. I can't see anything that there's any difference in there. I mean, they might be interested in different aspects of the driver's art or the engineering or strategy or whatever, but I think it's pretty much universal. And I'm just so pleased that we have this fan base, male and female, who are discovering what we've found so addictive all these years.
It's personality and great storytelling, yeah, right? That's what people are interested in. People are interested in people, and to varying degrees. Just to finish off then, you've been very generous with your time today, Ted, but let's talk a little bit about the current season and how you see it. Let me put you on the spot first of all and say, who's going to win the driver's title, Piastri or Norris?
Well, I was thinking this when you were asking about how different drivers react differently to interviews. And sometimes with Lando Norris, a little bit of an emotional, you should always have an emotional aspect to one of your two or three or four or five questions, because I remember interviewing him after Monaco, and there was a, he didn't really want to do the interview, if we're honest. It was after the team celebration, and the McLaren, the great McLaren press and PR people said, look, you know, you can have a word with him after the photo. And so I saw out the corner of my eye, because I was talking at the time, and part of the notebook is that you have to talk, and then you have to also plan what you're going to do next. It's quite difficult, requires both halves of your brain. And I could see him out the corner of my eye while I was talking I think it was Harry from McLaren saying, you're just going to do, you know, can you just do Sky? And he went like, oh, not another interview. I mean, he actually said not another interview and shook his head. And so I knew I was kind of onto a bit of a difficult one straight away. But then I kind of went in with, you know, you've done it. It was just a simple, you've done it. You've won Monaco. And sometimes it just needs a little bit of a moment like that. Whereas Oscar, very, very different character. And that's one of the interesting things for me of this season is seeing how these two, you know, who is actually ultimately quicker? Is it Lando, who in his bones is a tenth quicker, maybe half a tenth quicker than Oscar? But Oscar, only in his third year of Formula One, is he actually just coming in and will be just as quick or quicker, or is it the consistency thing or anything like that? Just because he's 31 points ahead as we're at the time of speaking, I would imagine Oscar Piastri will win the championship. I just wonder, though, who will react best? And you were as better than anyone in understanding and communicating the business end of a Formula One season. You sometimes called it squeaky bottom time, but borrowing a football phrase. But these races, Singapore, Austin, Qatar, Brazil, Mexico, these are intense races where something always happens, and it's who reacts best to them. And we've seen Max stepping up a gear. The best always step up a gear in those final few flyaway races, don't they? And I'm so fascinated to see which one of Norris and Piastri will be the one to step up a gear into those.
It's a shame that Norris had that engine failure, because it did sort of skew things a bit more than it was quite nicely set up, because he'd been strong in the run up to the summer break. But I mean, Nico Rosberg, I think, has been a real revelation, a really wonderful addition to the Sky broadcast team. You know, he's kind of fearless, really, but not in an outrageous way. But
yes.
So he's got a bit of his dad's kind of like, you know, I'll say what I mean as he gets older.
Yeah.
But he does it in a very good way. And I think he coined the phrase that this championship will be won or lost inside Lando Norris's head. Yeah. And I think that is absolutely true. But I just think that technical for Norris does slightly sort of tip the balance towards Piastri. Often collar their team principal at McLaren, Andrea Stella, after the race, because, you know, what's your view on the way he's managing this dynamic? For me, that decision in Monza to advantage Norris after the slow pit stop seemed like an odd one. And I do wonder whether he might be regretting that one now.
In terms of what? Because it sets a precedent, you feel?
Yeah, I just felt from Piastri's reaction when they told him over the radio that wasn't kind of part of things that they discussed. It's, you know, they've made some decisions, they've done things over the last few years. I mean, let's face it, you mentioned it in the book, Norris even pulled over at one point at the end of Qatar to hand a win to Piastri. I
mean, it's like shades of Austria.
Echo of Austria, but it wasn't something that he was like, you know, wasn't told to do it by Ross Brawn or whatever. But for me, that was a slightly odd move, and I just wondered whether or not you thought that anyway, the point is that the dynamic of trying to manage these two drivers, they've got away with it up to this point, but sooner or later it's got to unravel.
It was slightly odd. I mean, first of all, Stella is a deeply impressive man. He's a deeply impressive engineer and a deeply impressive manager and team principal. And I don't know about you, but when he was appointed after Seidel was off to Audi, Andreas Seidel, I did think, you know, if Ron Dennis was dead, he'd be rolling in his grave. I mean, you know, a man who won championships with Ferrari and very almost won some ones with Fernando Alonso at Ferrari quite recently, a Ferrari man being the McLaren team principal. What is going on? But he has just proved to be, you know, totally capable. I think, I wonder whether part of it is that Stella feels guilty that it was a McLaren part that led to the engine turning itself off. For Lando in Zandvoort, it was a carbon fiber pipe that failed before its life should have done, and that effectively switched the engine off because it was starved of oil. And wants somehow to even it up. I think had Piastri been any less than 31 or 34 points ahead, he just wouldn't have done it. And so he feels comfortable, but you know, there's nothing's comfortable until Abu Dhabi at the end of the season, are they? So I don't know. They might come to regret it. I think it does set a bit of a precedent, but something that I'll be following up in Azerbaijan is, you know, what are these? Obviously, the papaya rules, which McLaren insist are just don't crash into each other. They have discussed the fact that they've discussed what they will do in certain circumstances, which include a botched pit stop. Is quite interesting in itself, isn't it? And yeah. I think it occurred to me, going back to the curiosity, when Oscar said on that radio, well, that's something that we discussed would not be rectified on track or remedied. I thought, oh, was it? What else? You know, what are these meetings? How much else are you discussing? What's on the list? So yeah, I'll be trying to get some answers for that, because hopefully people are as curious as I am in finding out, because it will affect, again, going back to what you taught me, it will affect the racing. It will affect people's understanding of what they're watching going forward to the end of the season.
Well, there you go, Ted. That answers a perfect illustration of what makes you so good at what you do, is like all these little nuggets of information that we didn't know, and that you bring them to the fore. But yeah. Just to finish then, we asked the question on last week's podcast, who will be the first team after McLaren, who've been so dominant this season, but another team will win the Constructors' Championship at some point. And who is that going to be? What say you?
I think it's going to be Mercedes. James Allison, one of the only friends, I think I'd say, I have in the paddock. I found, I'm sure you did, it doesn't really pay to have any friends amongst people you might have to ask a tricky question. Not only because I think you couch what you're saying. Yeah, I don't want to have that playing on my mind, that I have this relationship with this person. We're friends off track. I don't want to have that. It's a millstone around your neck.
Really. Is that because of aeroplanes?
Yes, it is because, yeah, we go flying sometimes together. Yeah. So when we talk, when we don't talk about motor racing or teams or anything. When we're together, we talk about planes or we go flying together on the odd occasion. But on the record, it was something he said last year that when I was saying, God, there's, you know, these, the removal of the MGUH and the almost tripling of the electrical energy coming from the MGUK, you know, must be pretty difficult. And he's like, well, I think we're getting there. And it was just a little comment like that about Brixworth, about Mercedes high performance powertrains in Brixworth, that just made me think with this big change in the power units and the way that they're going to have to harvest electrical energy, having removed one of the great ways of doing it running a turbine off the turbocharger. Let's make your job three times harder, and we're going to take away a great way of giving you that electrical energy boost. Deal with that. Good luck with it. And I think if anyone can, they can. It's not to say that Ferrari can't. Honda obviously have aced the power unit regulations recently. You never know. Maybe it's simplistic to say to think that a first year power unit manufacturer in terms of Red Bull powertrains can't do it. There's no reason why they can't. They've got lots of good brain power from Mercedes. There's no reason to say they can't, but maybe you think history would suggest that they might not. And then, you know, we'll see what Audi come up with. But yeah. I'd say Mercedes.
Ted, it's been a great pleasure. Thank you so much for coming in. And please do, everybody, go out and buy his book, Ted Kravitz, F1 Insider, Notes from the Formula One Pit Lane. It's a great Christmas gift, and I hope it sells a lot. You've got a competition with Lazenby for who's going to climb up the Sunday Times bestseller list to the highest point?
Well, they're very different books. We like to think of it as a kind of Barbie and Oppenheimer, if you remember, if you remember the movies. Two very different movies. But
who's Barbie? Analogy.
Exactly. But side, they're very different books. Simon's is, Simon Lazenby's my Sky from colleague, is about some of those incredible characters in Formula One. He details about 20 characters, and mine is about some of the sort of best stories of the last 30 years. But, you know, I have to say thank you to you as well, James. You know, you defined the role of the modern pit reporter. Not only that, but you were in the room in that famous Damon Hill press conference in 1997 and gave me the names of the Chrysalis Sport producers to whom I wrote and asked whether they might need anybody who could log some tapes. So without you, I wouldn't be here and we wouldn't be doing this interview. It's a strange symmetry to it. But no one to this day, and not even I can claim this, no one encapsulates Formula One stories in a easily digestible way better than you do. So it's, thank you. And it's been an absolute pleasure catching up.
I remember a young kid coming up to me and saying he would like to get into Formula One. And there was just something about your natural curiosity, I think, and the fact that the way you did it, that just made me think, yeah, this guy deserves a chance. So anyway, you've taken it and you've done amazing things with it. My thanks to Ted. His book, F1 Insider, Notes from the Pit Lane, is out now wherever you buy your books. And remember to send in your comments and questions to @JamesAllen on F1 on X. My thanks to producer Ben, and thanks to you all for listening. Please click to follow or subscribe. Leave us a review and a rating and tell all your F1 mad friends about us. We'll be back with another podcast very soon.
You've been listening to the James Allen on F1 podcast, part of the Autosport Podcast Network. For the latest from our reporters at the racetrack during F1 weekends, check out the Autosport F1 channel, wherever you get your podcasts, including Apple and Spotify.